I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is Radio Boston on an historic November 8th, 2016.
So my name is Cassidy McAuliffe. I live in Lawrence. I'm 18. I'm a first-time voter, and I cast the first provisional ballot of the day at this polling station.
My name is Chris Tapgram. I'm born and raised in Roxbury, and I'm out today because it's clear that the black vote is going to make the change this year, and I want to make sure I'm part of that change.
Susan Cole, and I'm from Watertown. I feel very relieved. I'm very anxious, though, as to the outcome.
My name is Kathleen Evans. I live in Somerville. I'm feeling hopeful, optimistic, but overall pretty nervous.
I'm Jeff Murphy from Watertown, Massachusetts. I'm glad to see, you know, a giant line here at my local polling station.
Paula Johnson. It's going fantastic. It's great voter turnout. The lines are long. No problems whatsoever. A lot of thumbs up.
All across New England, where a presidential race could be up for grabs in New Hampshire, to ballot questions that could shape the future of Massachusetts, this has been one for the record books. And this hour, we'll hear from reporters, historians, analysts, and you. How are you feeling on this election day? What was it like where you voted? What are you most passionate about? And how do you feel about the future? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Well, let's jump first right to New Hampshire, a state that emerged late in the race as a linchpin for any presidential path to 270 electoral votes. And joining us is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. He's at a polling station in Manchester, Ward 1. Anthony, it's good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, Meghna. Beautiful day here in New Hampshire.
Good day for voting. Also with us is the executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Trent Spinnards. Trent, it's good to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Anthony, first, you're at a polling station and you've been around most of the day and the morning. What's it been like up there in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so I'm in Ward 1 in Manchester at the Webster Elementary School. This is a ward that's sort of an interesting place to try to get an early read on the results. This is a ward that where Democrats have a slight edge, and so you'd expect perhaps more voters to be coming out for Hillary Clinton. And based on my very unscientific polling of a dozen or maybe two dozen people or so, I'd say there's a majority of folks saying they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. The two sentiments that I'm hearing here are, finally, what a relief. Let's get this over with. This has been exhausting. It's time to do it and get on with it. And the other sentiment I'm hearing are a lot of folks, even the folks who are saying they're voting for Clinton, they're doing it not with a lot of enthusiasm. It's this sort of sense of one person even used this incredible metaphor, saying it's like voting between tuberculosis and cancer.
Oh,
I'm voting
my
for tuberculosis because I can recover and survive from tuberculosis, but maybe not cancer.
Wow.
He was voting for Hillary Clinton.
Well, Trent, I mean, I'm seeing reports that poll workers in New Hampshire expect a post-work a surge of voters as well. I mean, is it possible to tell which candidate that's good for?
Yeah, it's going to be difficult to tell. And that, just going back to what Anthony said, that's a funny anecdote. You know, the people in New Hampshire can always be very colorful and always give you good quotes. You know, I think that we are going to see historic turnout today. I am hearing about places that have seen record numbers before the work hours, like before even 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. I think lines have kept up throughout the day, and I think at 5 o'clock we are going to see an absolute crush of people. And so one thing we'll have to look at is where these groups of people are. There's a kind of Republican triangle where I think Trump will do pretty well, just south of where your reporter is in Manchester, all the way down to Nashua, and then across Rockingham County to Salem. So I think if we see a big turnout in that area, that'll be good for Trump. If we're seeing big turnout at some of the college campuses like in Durham or Hanover, where Dartmouth College is, I think that'll be better for Hillary Clinton. So that will be one important thing to keep an eye on tonight.
Well, so Anthony, talk about that. I mean, New Hampshire received an extraordinary amount of attention from both campaigns in the last couple of weeks. Candidates, their very top surrogates, all flooding the state. Do you think voters, in a sense, feel the pressure about how important the four electoral votes are?
Well, I'm not sure if feel the pressure is the right term, but there's certainly a lot of awareness of it. I mean, Meghna, as you and I have been talking about this week, you know, Donald Trump was here on Friday. President Obama was here yesterday. In between, Chelsea Clinton was here. Hillary Clinton was here Sunday night. I mean, it's just been a steady flow. And rarely does a general election sort of lead up to a general election in New Hampshire feel like this. This feels more like the primary when the whole nation is focused on New Hampshire. And obviously, one of the reasons it feels this way is because New Hampshire has become such an important state, particularly for Donald Trump in his effort to get to 270 electoral votes. There's one argument that this is one of the essential pieces of the puzzle for him, and that's why there's such a focus on it. With polls tightening all over the country, it's also important for Clinton to make a stand here as well.
Right. And so, Trent, what do you think today's huge turnout might mean for that also all-important Senate race between Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan?
The Senate race is something that I think is going to keep us up pretty late tonight and may not even be decided tonight. I think that what we're going to see is people from both sides. I think you know, somewhere between 40 and 45% of people are decided on this, and they're either going to vote for the Republican Kelly Ayotte or the Democrat Maggie Hassan. And I think what we're going to need to figure out is just how many undeclared voters, how many people in the middle are going to go with Hassan or AI, and they're going to decide this race. I think it's going to be incredibly close. I really do not believe any of the latest polls. They've had this race up and down for both sides, and I don't think that it's that these polls have been accurate. I think both campaigns really think they're going to win this one, and they're fighting to the end. So I don't know what turnout's going to do. I think that this race will possibly go to tomorrow. It may not be decided tonight.
Right. Well, Trent Spinner is executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader. Trent, thank you as always for joining us, and have a great rest of the day.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Anthony, one more question for you before we have to let you get back to work. Where else are you planning to be today, and what do you hope to see?
Well, interesting to hear Trent talk about sort of the way, you know, where the Republicans are strong and where the Democrats are strong in this state. I'm definitely in a ward right now that favors the Democrats. So I want to go into some of those wards that are a little more favoring the Republicans to try and get a sort of more balanced view of what voters are saying there. So I'm going to be heading there. And then I'll be spending a lot of the evening at Democratic National Headquarters, Democratic State Headquarters in Manchester, and participating in our coverage on WBUR all through the evening.
Great. Well, looking forward to hearing you then. Anthony Brooks, senior political reporter for WBUR, speaking to us from Manchester, New Hampshire. Anthony, thank you as always.
My pleasure, Meghna. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later. You're listening to a special Election Day edition of Radio Boston. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let us know how you're feeling on this Election Day, what you're excited about, what you're nervous about, and what you make of election 2016. Let's take a quick call here from Mary, who's calling from Wilson, New Hampshire. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What's your thought today?
So I'm just absolutely excited. This is probably the most exciting day of the year for me. I voted for Obama in his second term when I was 20. It was my first presidential election. Being able to do another historical vote for Hillary in New Hampshire is just absolutely amazing. I can't believe it's the day is finally here. It's been a long, good 16 months that we've been doing this. So the day is finally here, and I'm so proud to put my vote in for her. And it's coming from Cambridge, Mass, all the way to New Hampshire. It's really fun to kind of put my name in that historical change.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for doing your civic duty with such enthusiasm, and thank you for your call. Let's turn now to a couple of people with a long view on American elections and therefore the significance of this one. Heather Cox Richardson joins us. She's a professor of history at Boston College and author of the book To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Heather Cox Richardson, it's great to have you back.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Alexander Kasar, professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. Alexander Kasar, it's great to have you back as well.
It's a pleasure to be here, Meghna.
So let me just first ask both of you, I mean, how do you think election 2016 in your minds compares to past elections? Is there a specific one that this one feels like, or is it truly unprecedented? Alexander, go ahead.
we were looking at each other, saying you first.
This is pretty unique, I think. Certainly as a general election. I mean, I think that the extent of tension and hostility, the breaking of a lot of canons of civility make it unique. It's not unique, I think, in terms of the disparateness of positions. I mean, the 1964 election between Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater was really capturing, you know, polls. The 1948 election, to go way back into ancient history, when there were four candidates, one sort of very progressive liberal, Henry Wallace, and then you had Dewey and Truman, and then you had Strom Thurmond as a Dixiecrat at the other end.
Yeah.
Also had a lot of elements like this.
So we're marching back in history a little bit here. I mean, Heather Cox Richardson, would you take us even further back?
I'll take us all the way to 1816, because what's interesting to me about this election is, yes, it's unique in many ways, but it is also a major realignment election like 1816, like 1860, like 1884, like 1896, like more recently the elections around the 1930s. And what we got out of all of those incredibly divisive, angry elections when people literally would cross the street rather than talk to each other were periods of great calm in America and great progressivism in America. And what looks fascinating to me is for all the vitriol of this campaign and all of the anger surrounding it, I really do think what will come out of it is an era that looks much like the much calmer 1950s progressive era.
I gave you a raised eyebrow there because that seems rather optimistic. Do you share that optimism, Alexander?
No, not at all. I mean, Heather, you want to continue on explaining the optimism and then I can explain why I'm
why you're pessimist? Okay, go ahead.
No, I actually want to hear about the pessimism.
Okay. Well, I think that underlying this election and congressional elections at the same time is a fundamental quarrel over the political economy of the country and about whether or not to roll back, in effect, the gains that were produced by 50 years of policies. In what was the grand bargain of the 20th century was to say capitalist enterprise would endure, things would not be nationalized, but there would be regulation, there would be social insurance, there would be a broad franchise, and there would be strong unions. That was the deal that was forged between the progressive era and the 1960s. For the last 25 years, the Republicans have been trying to unravel that deal, and the Democrats have been trying to maintain it, maybe advance it a little bit with the Affordable Care Act.
I mean, the left wing of the Democratic Party would say that the centrist wing was also trying to unravel.
Yes, exactly. And I would agree with that. But still, they've been trying to hold the line in some places. And I guess my reason for pessimism is that I don't think that fight is over. Mm. I think that the quarrel over that basic political economy is going to continue.
So, and I disagree, because I think that what we're seeing in this election is exactly what you say, that since the New Deal, there has been initially a rump group, but a rump group that took over the Republican Party in the 1960s, 1970s, and then again with Reagan in 1980, by harnessing that attempt to get rid of government regulation and basic social welfare legislation, by tying it to the idea of race, the idea that an active government, by definition, was redistributing wealth from white people to black people, other minorities, and later women and workers. And that has been under attack, really, the whole concept of, as you say, the liberal consensus, if you will, the New Deal America has been under attack since the 1950s. But I think this is the election where the movement conservatives who stood against that idea, who took over the Republican Party, have played out their hand. I mean, I think most people look at what the extremists who have backed Mr. Trump and say this is not the America they want. This is the moment when the tide starts turning the other way.
Okay, but in terms of the Republican Party itself, the movement conservatives, as you say, if they have played their hand, to be replaced by what?
You want to go ahead?
No.
To be replaced by a much more moderate Republican Party.
Really?
Yes, I do think so. And you know, there's a number of
bellwethers. And not the party of Trump?
not the party of Trump. It's going to become a third rail, the way we've always had that underground radicalism, right-wing radicalism in America. We've always had it. Sometimes it gets very powerful, like it did in the 1920s with the KKK. But then that sort of racist, sexist, horrifically xenophobic part
How
of America
can that
goes-
be possible when the supposed level-headed leadership of the GOP, the Paul Ryans of the world, stood by their man?
They are not traditional Republicans. They're movement conservatives. All those people looked very much the same in this 2016 election. But I do believe, having studied the Republican Party for my entire professional career, that most Republicans really do believe in a social compact, and they believe in equality of opportunity, and they don't believe in creating a set of policies that move all the wealth to the top, which is what we've had since 1980. And I think they're going to take their party back. And you know, one of the bellwether pieces of this I see is Glenn Beck 2 days ago coming out and saying, oopsie poopsie, I made a mistake. I didn't really think all the things I said. And I don't think he believes it. I think he's a salesman. But I think the fact that he sees the tide has turned and is going that direction is a hugely significant political moment.
Alexander Kasar, chime in here.
I think that the problem is, for one thing, it's interesting that we're presuming here in this discussion that Trump is going to lose.
I do not make that presumption.
No, but I'm saying in the way this conversation has unfolded, because obviously they will not have spent their energy if they win. Then it is Trump's party. What strikes me is that using him as something of a symbol, but Paul Ryan has become the emblem of the reasonableness in the Republican Party, and Paul Ryan really is a very, very right-wing ideologue, and that he has emerged now as at least in public eyes as the kind of caretaker of the mainstream of the party who will be in charge if Trump loses alarms me.
Right. Well, we are speaking with Alexander Kasar. He's a professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of The Right to Vote. We're also talking with Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. And we want to hear from you on this special Election Day Radio Boston. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. What do you think the future of the GOP and the Democratic parties are going to be after today? What direction do you want to see either of them go? Again, call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And as we head into a break, let's hear some more from voters about what brought them to the polls today.
I vote no matter what. I always come out and vote. Controversy, no controversy, I'm here. I have that right, that privilege. I'm going to use it.
I just like Trump, the way he says things, and hopefully he does the good deed and wins the presidency.
I'm voting for my daughters. I'm voting for this historic day and for a candidate who's competent, who's amazing, who's qualified, and who will unify the country.
Welcome back to a special Election Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've been speaking with Heather Cox Richardson and Alexander Kasar. Today we'll hear from both of them and more a little bit in just a second. But let's turn now to Maine, where Donald Trump visited 5 times in the last year. 3 of those visits have been to the 2nd congressional district there. And why is that? Well, Maine splits its electoral college votes. So for more on the election in Maine, we're joined by Maine Public Radio reporter Fred Bever from East End Community Schools in Portland. That's one of the polling stations there. Fred, it's good to have you.
It's good to be with you.
It's great to have. So first of all, Fred, tell us, what's turnout been like in Maine and what's the atmosphere there on Election Day?
It's been very strong in the morning. I think that there was a big boost in early attendance here at the East End Community School. There was actually information that the polls would be open an hour earlier than they were. So there were hundreds of people lined up, and it took them almost 3 hours to clear that. Maine always votes in high numbers, in the 70% range. It looks like the state's on track to make a record.
Mm. Now, Donald Trump has spent a lot of time in the 2nd congressional district, specifically there. Does he think that he can actually win that district and therefore maybe peel away at least one, if not more, of the electoral votes in Maine?
Yes, he clearly does. That many visits by a presidential candidate is unprecedented in Maine, even though we're close to New Hampshire, and the district is sort of ripe for his plucking because it has a very high proportion of his demographic. It's white voters who lack a college degree, and particularly in the North Woods of Maine and in the rural areas that make up the second district, it's been tough times. It's hit with opiate addiction. It's been seen many job losses in the forestry sector, which people blame on free trade, jobs going overseas. There's been an influx in the biggest city in the second district, Lewiston, of Somali refugees and immigrants, which, while has produced some, you know, some good, you know, wonderful integrative moments, has also produced some resentments and friction. So there are a lot of issues that are fermenting in the second district that Trump appeals to.
Right. Well, that's Maine Public Radio reporter Fred Bever, who joined us from East End Community Schools in Portland. Fred, thanks so much.
Thank you, Megna.
Let's take a quick call here. Bob is calling from Nottingham, New Hampshire. You're on the air, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just want to make a comment. I'm actually running for Registry of Probate in Rockingham County, a know-nothing position on the Democratic side. And just talking to the conversation, and one of the theories, and I graduated a poli sci degree a long time ago, but I look at this race as a 45-year-old Democrat white male. I think this comes down to America being more colorful now, and I think that the reason why a lot of people are so excited for Donald Trump is not because of his antics, but I think it's more about race and how things are beginning to change. And I think that it's very scary in this country because we've been so, you know, even with Obama, I think that this country is moving forward. And I don't think a lot of Americans, not necessarily being racist, but I think change is scary.
Right. And so, Bob, let me take it back from you because I take your point, and thank you so much for your call. Heather Cox Richardson, let me just turn to you very briefly, because there have been times, I mean, multiple times in U.S. history, where race played an extraordinarily important role in sort of the realignments and election results, and even in the way that candidates talked about what was at stake. I mean, that's also what we're seeing this time around, right?
It is. And it's worth emphasizing the fact that race is never not an issue in America. But after the Civil War, when the Republicans during the Civil War had first created an active government, after the war, when they used that active government to help African Americans, opponents of black rights said that this is what an active government would do, is it would simply redistribute tax dollars from white people to black people. And that formula has skewed American politics ever since at crucial moments. And it is the formula on which the movement conservatives that Alex was talking about, who don't like regulation, don't like social welfare legislation, managed to crack the liberal consensus of the 1950s, the New Deal and Eisenhower's Republicans, by saying, no, an active government is actually simply going to take white tax dollars and give it to minorities and later women. And that, I think, is the what you're seeing right now is the extremes of that rhetoric taken to as far as they can, at least we hope as far as they can go with the Trump campaign. But also, at the end of the day, Americans actually like a government that, as Alex points out, regulates the economy and helps social welfare. So times are changing, but I think this is a realignment election where people say, wait a minute, no, this has gone way too far. We actually want to go back to that liberal consensus, if you will, small L liberal consensus.
Right. Well, I want to refocus here just for a second on the state of Massachusetts, because we've got a lot of politics going on here, particularly with ballot questions. Governor Charlie Baker, he cast his vote today, but for the first time in his life, he told reporters this morning he did not vote for president.
I said many months ago that I wasn't going to be able to support Donald Trump for a number of reasons, and that I thought Hillary Clinton had believability problems, and nothing's happened in the past 9 months to change my mind on that.
Well, as I mentioned, the governor, however, has thrown his political weight into two ballot questions, stumping in support of more charter schools and arguing against marijuana legalization. So we were wondering what effect this election and its outcomes, which we obviously do not yet know, but what effect it could have on Governor Baker's future political capital. So joining us now is Peter Ubertasio. He's political science professor and director of the Joseph Martin Institute for Law and Society at Stonehill College. Peter, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, look, Governor Baker is supremely popular. We've got recent polls from both BUR and the Boston Globe that have his approval rating at 70%. So is anything at stake for the governor in this election?
Sure. I mean, I don't think anything too significant. He's not going to emerge later on this week unpopular. He still has great affection among the citizens of Massachusetts. But I think, opponents are always looking for ways to kind of pierce the armor. And if he suffers some losses with the ballot questions and some of his legislative candidates lose, I think that, he's a little wounded, but not seriously wounded.
Mm. Now, what about the fact that he, as he said this morning, he did not cast any kind of vote for a presidential candidate? I mean, what's your take on that as a political decision?
I don't think that harms him. I think that he will come under some criticism from folks who feel like, if you're going to take a point of going to the polls and then not exercising a vote for that most significant office when you have the option of writing someone in, that is telling. I think some Democrats who are really concerned about Trump and his base of support here in Massachusetts, might find in the governor's decision a desire for the governor to play too cute by half, and trying to have it both ways. But again, I don't think that is going to seriously harm him as he moves into his own reelection.
Hmm. Now, the governor also told the reporter's gaggle this morning that he's been really focused on those down-ballot races here in the state. State House News Service says that the governor's taken part in at least 64 campaign events for Republican candidates since February. Most of those were fundraisers. 9 were rallies. So talk about that. I mean, how much political capital is the governor putting towards preserving whatever seats he does have in terms of his party in the state house?
Well, he's put some political capital toward it. He's not put a tremendous amount. He hasn't endorsed every Republican that's running. He hasn't appeared with all of them or done significant events with all of them. And I think that's for very good reason. He understands that in a good year for Democrats, and a presidential election year is almost always a good year for Democrats in Massachusetts, he recognizes that whether some of the Republican candidates win or not, he's got an overwhelmingly Democratic legislature that he needs to deal with. And so he's been, I think, rightfully reticent to go all in this cycle. His party may suffer some losses, but even if they suffer some wins, which would be extraordinary, as Hillary Clinton's going to lead Democrats to a pretty big win here, he's going to have to deal with Speaker DeLeo and Senate President Rosenberg at the end of the day, and he knows that they have a lot of Democrats in the legislature.
Well, Peter, New Hampshire has a gubernatorial race going on right now, and if the Republican wins there in New Hampshire, and also if there's a Republican win in Vermont, which might be possible, that would mean that 4 of the 6 governors in New England may be Republican after this election. And Charlie Baker, I'd say, has possibly the highest national profile amongst all of them. There's been a lot of attention on Massachusetts for, say, the charter school ballot question as well, and the governor's support of that. I mean, talk about him for a second or two here about his national stature as a Republican governor in a New England state.
It really cuts two ways. One, in some ways, he's the most popular governor or one of the most popular governors in the country, one of the most popular Republicans in the country. And so he's going to be much sought after. And we've seen him travel in a limited way to Republican audiences around the country who want to listen to him, want to hear from him, see how he's doing, and also because he's got some interesting and innovative ideas. But in terms of electoral viability, it ends at the border of Massachusetts. It simply does not extend to the National Republican Party as it is currently constituted.
Peter Ubutasio is a political science professor and director of the Joseph Martin Institute for Law and Society at Stonehill College. Peter, it's great to have you. Thank you so much.
Great to talk with you.
Alexander Kesar, you were sort of nodding your head yes there when Peter Ubutasio said that he didn't believe that Governor Baker's viability as a national level Republican, because of what the GOP is now, it necessarily extends beyond Massachusetts borders.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true, and I think that the kinds of positions and views that Governor Baker holds simply would not sell in many other places of the country. I mean, I think there's another element which we need to bring into focus here, which is that the Republican Party has now become is now dominated by its southern wing, And the South, when you know, and I know those of us who live in this part of the country have trouble acknowledging this. The South is the largest region in the country. It has the most electoral votes. It has the most seats in Congress. And it is, I mean, it is changing in some places, but it is deeply, deeply conservative. The white population of the South is deeply conservative.
Let's take a couple calls here, and then Heather, I want to turn back to you. But let's first start with Brandy, who's calling from Roxbury. You're on the air, Brandy.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I would actually just like to echo some of Peter's sentiments about where I see the Republican and the Democratic Party going after this election. I mean, I think the fact that Mike Pence and Paul Ryan are considered elder statesmen and reasonable definitely pinpoints where the Republican Party is going. And on the other side, for the Democratic Party, when you think about some of the positions that Bernie Sanders had, which Hillary Clinton co-opted, the Democratic Party has become more progressive as well. So no matter who's elected today, I see there still being gridlock because of where both parties are headed.
Brandy, thank you so much for your call. Let's turn to Jeff, who's calling from Boston. He may have a slightly different view on where the parties are going. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I can understand that perspective of the last caller, but you know, this has also been a very painful election process. It's been like a circus, and I think the lack of popularity of right now these two presidential candidates is so huge that no matter who gets elected, let's assume that it is Clinton, for example, you know, somebody like Mitt Romney now looks fantastic to a lot of moderate voters, and it's going to be hard for either of these two candidates right now to be two-term presidents, because I think that people are really going to be looking for somebody who can sort of bring back a little bit of civility and try and, you know, steep away some of the craziness that came out. So I'm actually agreeing with Professor Cox Richardson, I think it is, who said that, you know, the extremity of this current cycle is actually going to really bring, you know, some of this back to the norm after.
Right. Jeff, thank you so much for your call. So Heather Cox Richardson, you've got a fellow traveler there in terms of optimism for America's political future.
Well, you know, we have been here before, after all. We look much right now like we did in the 1890s, when the Republican Party similarly sort of went very far to the right in terms of only supporting big business and not providing any sort of social welfare or any sort of government regulation of business. And if you look at the election of 1896, when the Republicans won by, I think it was about 6 points and looked like they had completely captured all of America, you would never have imagined that by 1912 you would have all four major people running for the presidency, including Teddy Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, and our largest percentage of voters for a socialist candidate, Jean Debs. They're all running very far to the left compared to anybody that we'd seen before. And you would never have seen that three cycles before. I think it's just a question of the pendulum snapping back. In terms of the fact that we have a Southern a Republican Party that's dominated by the South, for sure, and yet we also have a Republican Party that has not been able to win at a national level for cycles. And I think they recognize with the demographic shifting, millennials took over for baby boomers last August, a year ago August, they simply are not going to be able to keep running righter and righter and righter. They have got to find a way to pick up young people and minorities.
Hang in here for just a second, because we're seeing a little bit of news that Donald Trump is challenging results in a county in Nevada. Politico and the Associated Press are reporting that the Trump campaign has filed a lawsuit. They did so today, alleging the Clark County Registrar kept an early kept an early voting location open for 2 extra hours in order to help Democratic turnout. A Nevada election official told Politico that the state is reviewing the complaint, and Nevada, of course, is a major battleground state. I mean, Alexander Kasar, that brings us to this another major overhanging question over this election in terms of, you know, voter suppression, disenfranchisement, voter enrollment. I mean, what's your take on just people's access to the polls this time around?
Well, I think we don't know. And, you know, I think that, you know, the legal situation, which has been, you know, much in the news, is that Dozens of states have passed laws limiting access to the polls, passing government-issued ID laws. The laws were softened over the summer by federal courts, but there's a lot of indication that some states are trying to circumvent what the courts told them to do, including in North Carolina. There's certainly inevitably a lot of confusion about what the laws are, what the requirements are. One of the things which happens, for example, my understanding of the Nevada case is that you reduce the number of polling places, so lines get longer. and then there becomes a question of keeping the polls open after the official hour. We don't know yet how much impact that's going to have.
Now, what do both of you make about the fact that the talk about voting and the election being rigged again, and rigged, and I'm putting major air quotes around that, had so much resonance, or seemed to have so much resonance amongst so many in the electorate.
Well, 58% of self-identified Republicans say that they think that voter fraud is very common. I've actually studied this and done a lot of research on this and the whole question of, rigged elections. It is a trope tinged with racism and class bias, in which these other people are seen as acting in an undemocratic way and stealing elections. And there's simply no evidentiary basis for it.
Mm. Heather Cox
Richardson? Again, we saw this in the 1890s when the Republican Party no longer commanded a majority and had to find some way to explain why they were not commanding a majority. And what they came up with was exactly what Alex said, that there were these other people who did not know what was good for them, and they should not be polluting or corrupting the American population, the American voting population.
We've got just a little bit more time with both of you, and I want to ask you one question that gets us back to the future of either of these parties, because I quite frankly appreciated that we had a little bit of disagreement at this table. But regardless, I'm curious, for as long as we have, say, congressional seats that are drawn the way they are, and we have such a profound gerrymandering problem in this country, we had callers who hoped for a more centrist, optimistic future. Is that even possible when this major aspect of American politics is deliberately driven to the extremes?
Well, I'm going to go ahead and say yes, because one of the pieces that people don't see, and I'm very concerned about gerrymandering, of course, and we can't do anything about that until after the next census in 2020. Right. But all of these things and the idea of returning to a centrist political system in America, people seem to be looking at the idea that somehow we have to get rid of Republicans. And I actually completely disagree with that, the people on the far right of the Republican Party. In the past, whenever we get an extremist Republican Party like we've got now, or an extremist Democratic Party, what happens is not that they get read out of American politics. What happens is that the parties themselves become more moderate. And that's precisely what happened in the 1890s. It's precisely what happened in the 1930s and 1940s with the Republican Party. It's what happened with the Democrats after the debacle of 1972. I actually think that what's going to happen is we're going to get a sea change within the Republican Party, and then the gerrymandering is going to matter less.
Alexander Kasar?
Well, I hope they put Heather in charge of the Republican Party after this election and that she's able to execute this happy path. I mean, I completely agree about gerrymandering. It is frankly, I think, a more severe distortion of preferences than voter suppression is. It's extraordinary and long lived, and we haven't had very good ways of dealing with it. There are mechanisms. I mean, having independent districting commissions really makes a lot of progress. I think it's optimistic to think that very optimistic to think that we're going to overcome that problem in the foreseeable future.
Well, let's just recall that America can and should be an optimistic nation, so we will cling to that optimism. Alexander Kasar, professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and author of the right to vote, the contested history of democracy in the United States. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College and author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. It looks like you may have a new history to write in the years to come. Always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. And as we head into the break, let's listen to some more voters and the sense of relief they felt after casting their ballots.
I feel like now I can get back on Facebook because I haven't been on for 2 months. I'm tired of hearing about it.
I just am so sick of all the ads and the negative ads on all sides. And it's just the TV, that's all it's been on there is ads.
It's a relief to have it out of the way. It's been quite an election season, so I'm just glad it's over with.
Welcome back to this special Election Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Remember, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and we want to hear from you about how you're feeling on this Election Day, how you're feeling about the election that's going on right here in Massachusetts, and your vision for the state and the nation ahead. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We've got a tweet here from a person who identifies themselves as Boxer Dave. He said, "The country's soul has been broken by a broken, disordered personality, and healing somehow needs to happen." Well, let's turn our attention back right here to Massachusetts, where many voters are coming to the polls because of the state's four ballot questions. They range from gambling to animal welfare to marijuana legalization and, of course, to charter schools. Here are two voters we spoke with earlier today.
Yeah, so I'm working for the Yes on 2 campaign. I believe that charter schools should be extended, the opportunity for them to be extended. I think they've been very successful.
I'm here because I'm no on 2. I support a unified public school system that serves all children. For me, it's a matter of democracy.
Well, long lines are being reported at polling places across the state. In Jamaica Plain, the wait at the John F. Kennedy School was over 2 hours long at one point this afternoon. But let's turn now to WBUR reporter Zeninjor Mumeka, who's in East Boston. Zeninjor, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Meghna.
How does it look where you are at the polling place you are?
So right now I'm here in East Boston. I'm actually outside one polling location at the Curtis Guild School here. And things are pretty steady here. I haven't seen any long lines. Again, we're just before the expected evening rush. But there's been a steady flow of voters at the polling places that I've been, but no long waits right now.
And what's the mood at the polling place that you've been? Are you spoken to voters? What's bringing them to the polls?
Yeah, so many voters are pretty much relieved to have the voting process out of the way. There's been a lot of sentiment that, you know, oh, thank goodness this is finally over. I spoke to one gentleman at a different polling location in East Boston, and he basically said that the choices in this presidential election is like deciding between a Coke and a Pepsi, that basically if you peel the labels off, it's all the same. So there's been this sort of feeling of relief, but also just sort of resignation that, okay, you know, this is over. Let's move on.
Well, that's WBUR reporter Zeninjor Nwemeka reporting to us from East Boston. Zeninjor, thanks so very much.
You're welcome, Meghna.
Let's take a couple of quick calls here. Vika, is calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Vika.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. You were asking about what we're hoping for. And as I was listening to reports on NPR throughout the day of record books voter turnout already, even before the evening rush, I am terrified to hope, and yet I hope for a greater civic engagement on all sides.
Vika, thank you so much for your call. Tell me a little bit more, though. You have hope, but you said you were terrified at the same time?
Well, listen, I've been in this country for about 26 years. I grew up in the USSR, and in that totalitarian state, voting was really sacred civic duty, as far as my childhood eyes saw. And here, I just have never seen that. I have never seen people consider civic engagement sort of a sacred duty, except in certain circles. Huh. And I hope that that feeling expands through more of the population.
Vika, thank you so very much for your call and your perspective as well. Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We want to wrap up the end of this live special hour back in New Hampshire. Again, four very critical electoral votes at stake there. And WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks has been along for the New Hampshire ride for many, many weeks now. And let's check back in with him. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so you know, we've talked this hour with a bunch of people about the future of the Republican Party, the future of the Democratic Party, how people feel about this race. Do you have a sense, or do you have a feeling that the way the race has been played out there in New Hampshire could give us even a glimpse into what the future might be for either of these parties?
Boy, it's a really great question. I mean, the way I see this race in New Hampshire playing out, it's so interesting because of the Trump phenomenon. I mean, New Hampshire so often goes its own way. And, you know, there was a poll done early this week out of the UNH Polling Center that showed a big lead for Hillary Clinton. And that made me think, huh, so, you know, maybe New Hampshire kind of resists this Trump wave. On the other hand, you know, there's been a lot of energy for Trump voters. I mean, my colleague Fred Tice was at his final rally in Manchester yesterday, and it was just packed, and there was a huge amount of enthusiasm. So, in terms of where that what that says about how New Hampshire could define the future of the Republican Party, I'm not really sure, but I think if Trump wins in New Hampshire and it provides him with one of those key pieces toward an electoral college victory, then New Hampshire will have a lot to say about it. If he loses, then, it's just hard to say where he goes.
Right.
And I've been listening with interest to some of your conversation about what that means for the future of the Republican Party.
Now, Anthony, so very recently, millennials surpassed baby boomers in terms of their absolute numbers in the United States. And you and I have had so many conversations the past couple of weeks about the focus on millennial voters in New Hampshire. I mean, and tell us more about that and how that might carry forward past today.
Well, see, this is really interesting. I was just looking at numbers from Secretary of State William Gardner, who basically says he expects 90,000, or about 10% of the electorate, to be same-day voter registrants. And this is connected to your question in this way. Those voters, traditionally, same-day registrants, tend to be younger voters who tend to vote Democratic. And in this case, they really could be the key to the outcome of this election, which is really interesting. They tend to be Democratic, but this year that formula could be different because, we don't know if a lot of those same-day registrants are going to be Trump supporters of all ages who are coming out for the first time or maybe for the first time in a really long time. But if it follows the traditional pattern, they tend to be younger voters, and they could have a lot to say. We certainly know that the numbers are there for them to determine the outcome. So that'll be one of the really interesting questions that we'll get an answer to at the end of today.
Yeah. So, Anthony, we've got just a couple seconds here. I mean, you have been covering political white races for the White House for some time. You were on the campaign trail for that hotly contested 2000 election. Does this one feel like one for the record books, too? Or do you expect we're going to have a long night in front of us?
You know, I here's what I think could happen tonight. If the polls close on the East Coast and Clinton wins Florida, we're going to have a pretty clear sense early on where this election is going. If not, if Trump gets Florida and begins to rack up some victories on the East Coast, then we could be in for a long night. Yes, this is one for the record books, and it makes me think a lot about the year 2000. Absolutely.
Well, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks joining us from Manchester, New Hampshire. You got a long night ahead of you, Anthony, so thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Meghna. Thank you.
And by the way, join WBUR tonight for our special election night coverage. We kick off at 7 o'clock with a special live On Point with Tom Ashbrook. Then as the results roll in, Bob Oakes, WBUR reporters, and the NPR politics team will bring you live news and analysis. And don't forget, you have until 8 o'clock tonight to vote in Massachusetts. Do your civic duty. Do your job. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.